So, as Mr. Jason Barnard is with us, fresh from his interview with one of the mamas and papas.
Well, this is the only living one. So
the only one.
I haven't had a seance with John Phillips.
All I do for you when you fucking humiliate me.
The last time I'm on stage, isn't it?
Yeah. He's interviewed Michelle Phillips, and that's all he's talked about. All week. I forgot your name now. Oh, Jason Barnard. And our very special guest, a true legend, it has to be said. Don't be shy, Paul. Paul Hanley.
Welcome to the Cat Club, Paul.
I apologise. I didn't realise we were clapping. You clapped me, I didn't clap you. So can we just do that again?
So, Paul, not only have we got your latest book, 16 again, but there's the other books that you've written which have a connection with Manchester. Where does this book about Buzzcocks fit in with the last few that you've done? How has that progressed to Buzzcocks?
Well, the first book I did there, Leave the Capital, is kind of the story of how a couple of the guys, people from, who were in Manchester bands in the 60s, kind of sold the seed for what came later, really. Because the big thing with that was every book about Manchester music starts with the Sex Pistols gig at the Free Trade Hall. So my first book, I thought, well, I'm going to have to go back and put that right. But now I've put that right, I think I'm allowed to write a book that starts Sex Pistols coming to mind. So, so they kind of both feed in. They're both about people who decide, rather than going to London, they'll do something back up north, which is basically the thread that runs from Graham Goldman and Eric Stewart out of 10cc and Pete Shelley and Howard DeVoto. Basically, that's why should London have all the best stuff? Is basically that's the mantra by which I live my life. So yeah, so those two link together quite nicely, I think.
But there's something particularly special about Buzzcocks, isn't there? Because of as a team reading, they were your band, weren't they?
They were. Yeah. Well, I mean, I started off with the idea of writing a band about Buzzcocks because they're great, and then it turned into a book about Buzzcocks. They're great, and this is why I think they're great, and this is why they're great to me. Because you can read a perfectly good book about a band you have no interest in, or you don't even think it's very good. If the person writing them about them is enthusiastic enough, you know, I'd read a book from someone who said that the Rubettes were the greatest white band of the 20th century. They'd be wrong, but if they could convincingly argue that in a book, that'd be great. But the thing about Buzzcocks is they are actually fantastic, and I don't think they get half as much credit as they should. I certainly don't think Pete Shelley gets the credit as a songwriter, let's put it.
There's something particular about the Buzzcocks in that you can kind of relate to them. They're a bit more on your level than maybe the Sex Pistols, who were a bit scary, or the Clash, who were a bit aloof at times.
Yeah, the way I describe it in the book is the Clash and the Sex Pistols looked like they'd kick my head in, and there were enough people in my life when I was 14 ready, quite happy to kick my head in, that I didn't want my favourite band to be the same. So the Buzzcocks looked more like they make you a cup of tea, which was suited me right down the gander. And he had a unique ability, I think, Pete Shelley, to sort of articulate that awkward 14. And it lasted for, it wasn't, you know, he could sing convincingly about being 14, 15, 16, well into his, you know, into his 40s and 50s. And it wasn't jilted John. It wasn't talking down, and it was real and heartfelt, in every sense of the word, heartfelt. So, yeah, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves. And they meant an awful lot to me. So, in the end, I hope the book explains, A, why they were great, and B, why they meant so much to me, which aren't necessarily the same thing.
But with a song like 16 again, you must have been about 16. So
I was 14 when that album came out, because that's kind of burned in my memory, that album, because that was the one, that's Love Bites. That was the one where we determined we were going to get it the day it came out. And we also determined we couldn't wait till after school, because they made it be known in the record shops like Piccadilly Records in Manchester, they were going to have some badges that went with the album if you got there early and got it. So me and my friends at school thought, there's no way we can wait till, we're not going to get there till half four. So we snuck out of school at lunchtime to buy it, to make sure we got the badges. So that's the most sort of pivotal album in my life, I think, really. that day, the day you got in, you get home and you got that album and you go home on the bus. I mean, I know it's a cliche about people talk about downloading. It's not the same, but there is something. It's a, the process of traveling to a place to buy a physical object at no small expense. But it, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, aren't they? People come around here to listen to a record. But that there's something about that, I think, that which is the obverse of that is the easier music is to get hold of, the less you value it, I think.
It's the full package, isn't it? It's the design, it's the look, it's opening it up, it's getting the vinyl out.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a completely different thing to just pressing play on Spotify.
It is. And Buzzcocks were a sort of paragon of that, really, because everything about them was well designed, you know. Even the plastic bag that you got with the album on the first album, it came in its own bespoke plastic bag with product written on it matching. And the label wasn't the United Artists standard label. The inner sleeve wasn't just a paper bag. Everything about it was designed to the nth degree. And to me, I just thought it was almost important as the music in a way, the design of the album.
Mate, it's worth kind of covering the design because it's not like they got the label and then someone they didn't know to do the designs. These were people on the Manchester scene that they knew, and it fitted the music perfectly as well, you know, the angular nature.
Yeah. I mean, there's a school of thought that it fits because you see it and then you make it fit, you know what I mean? You see that design before you hear the record. If you buy it the day it comes out.
But you're not, if it was some sort of Yes mythical space landscape, it's not going to work with...
No, clearly not, no, but... There's the kind of in tandem, really. I can't, but I'm sure better, cleverer people than me can separate them, but I can't. It's like the fifth member of the band is the design, as far as I was concerned. And I just loved it. I just loved everything about it, you know, especially the little badges were just... I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say that the badge, one of the badges was almost as important as the music, but it kind of was, in a way.
You followed that through with your book, though. You've got Malcolm Garrett doing the design, and
I know I keep saying that if I got back in the time machine and visited my 14-year-old self and said Malcolm Garrett's going to design your book, you know, well, A, he'd say, "Who are you, old man?" And B, he wouldn't believe it. But no, so that's an amazing thing.
Have you got your own badge?
Got my own badge? Yes. Oh yes. He's designed some special ones for Sunday with a date on it. I've got another date, and he's coming along, and he's designed a bespoke badge just for that day. I should have got him to do one for this, but there you go.
Let's set this in context in terms of Buzzcocks, because you do tell the arc of the Buzzcocks story. Circumstances and events seem to sort of almost magically align for the group, even reading about the Sex Pistols and then going off to try and find them. The way that things happen just seem to be like magic.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's looking down the other end of the telescope, but you don't know how many bands went off to find the Sex Pistols and didn't find them, you know. But that's the thing. So they're sat in the refectory at Bolton College, and everybody read the NME, you know, cover to cover. And if you look at a facsimile of that NME, there's a Carly Simon gig, and it tucked in the middle of the Sex Pistols supporting the Eddie and the Hot Rods at the Marquee in London. And if you read it's not particularly praiseworthy. It's an interesting thing, and it's not that big an article, but halfway down it says they do No Fun by the Stooges. And that was enough to make Howard and Pete say, well, I'll tell you what, we'll have to go and find them and go and see them. I mean, which is quite a big thing. I mean, getting to London in 1976 wasn't as easy as it is now, I don't think. So they borrowed a car and they went down, and even then, they get to London, they got no idea the Sex Pistols could have been anywhere in London. So they ring the NME. I mean, the NME wasn't a small... It was selling a lot of papers then, the NME.
Hundreds of thousands.
They rang the NME on spec, and the guy who wrote the review answered the phone and said, oh, yeah, I don't know where they are. I don't know where their band are, but I know that the manager's got a shop called Sex and on the King's Road. So they went thinking it was like a marital age shop, if you like. Well, you would, wouldn't you? And they turned up, and it was like 5 minutes before he was closing, and he was like, what the hell are you doing here? And they happened to have a gig that night. So there's so many of them things could have gone wrong. Nobody could have answered the phone at the NME, because I don't think it was the most meticulously run place. The guy might not have been there. He might not have known himself how to get hold of him. He could have gone to the shop and Malcolm Claret closed 5 minutes earlier. He could have got to the shop and said, well, they're not playing for another 2 weeks. Anything to them could happen, but he didn't. It all happened, and they had two gigs, High Wycombe and Welwyn Garden City, this Friday and the Saturday. So they managed to get down to see them twice, managed to speak to the band, and then managed to convince them to come up to Manchester to play a gig as well. So, I mean, all that is just, it's kind of fairy tale stuff, isn't it, really?
But the do-it-yourself element seems to come through, whether it's setting up a gig at the Free Trade Hall or later on in terms of Spiral Scratch. It's they're not waiting for a record company or a big management to, they were just going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that was much Richard Boone, who was the manager as well, he was involved. That was a massive thing that nobody did that, really. I mean, they were stiff, but they were kind of record company insiders, weren't they? Yeah. Nobody did their own label. I think the Drones had tried it, and then basically they couldn't get in the garage for the next 5 years because they had no way of selling any of these things. It was kind of a vanity project, really. Whereas Buzzcocks, they not only found a recording studio, because, I mean, it was, you were talking about, I've decided I'm going to build a rocket and go to the moon. In terms of what people did, it just didn't happen. So they found a record, a recording studio. They found someone who'd press it for them. And then they did the sleeves themselves and took the picture themselves and did all that. And that kind of kickstarted a whole, I mean, a massive industry. I mean, any indie label in English indie or Scottish label UK I mentioned was they took their cue from New Hormones, which was that label that brought out, you know, Rough Trade, Postcard, any of them, Fast, and Factory as well, you know, it was all that.
But Spiral Scratch, the EP, after the initial run, it was selling decent amounts. So there was something about people, kids around the country connecting with Buzzcocks.
It was an idea this time had come, hadn't it? That was, I think, that was the whole thing. I mean, I think there's a lot of nonsense talked about. There was a swathes of kids who were completely and utterly bored with music waiting for something to happen. They all loved music and they all went to gigs all the time and they all bought records when they could afford them. But that idea that you being stood there as part of the audience, you were as much a part of the scene as the guy up on the stage and you were interchangeable, that he could be in the audience watching you in your band, you could be in the audience watching him, you know, that whole thing that anybody can get up and be in a band, you know. I mean, there was always that, you know, people always form bands, but there was definitely something in the air, and certainly in London and certainly in Manchester, where all these creative people came together and there was no barrier to them doing it, which was unprecedented, I think.
But Howard didn't stay for long, did he? Because you talked about creative forces. You've got Pete and Howard, but Howard left.
Well, I think he went to finish his degree, I think. I think right. he switched his degree twice, and they were basically saying to him, listen, if you bugger this up this time, that's it. You know, you've done 4 years of your degree, you've swapped once, you're about to fail your third year. So I think that was his main reason. I think you put there's a bit of post rationale about him saying he was bored with punk and, you know, and it's become clean old hat and all this, which was kind of true. In terms of, he kind of painted himself into a corner in Buzzcocks. He was basically doing an impression of Johnny Rotten. And I mean, both in the way he sang and the way he wrote lyrics. And I think he got to the point where I can't do that anymore. Well, he could have done it. I mean, Buzzcocks changed their sound when he left. They could have changed their sound and him stayed in the band. But obviously, from my point of view, I'm very glad he did leave because A, you got Magazine, who were a great band, but B, it meant that Pete Shelley could sing and write his own songs, which would have been a travesty if that hadn't happened, I think.
Well, that's another example of circumstance.
Yeah.
I mean, it pushed Pete forward.
It did, yeah. I mean, much like it thrust Barney forward in New Order, you know. But I think Pete was a much more comfortable frontman than Bernard Sumner, I mean, was, certainly for the first few years in New Order. He was clearly struggling with it. Whereas Pete, the first time they ever did a gig with him singing, you could say, well, this is great, this is going to work. You can just see it, you can hear it. If you listen to the recordings of like the earliest gigs with him singing, he sings Howard's songs at least as convincingly as Howard does. Probably more, I think.
And the early days of Magazine and the relative early days of Buzzcocks, you've still got a bit of that crossover where some of the songs that Pete did with Howard were...
Well, they were kind of a collective, I think. So there was Howard and Pete, and Linda, who was the designer, who was the friend of theirs, and Malcolm Garrett, who designed the sleeves, they kind of were like a four Way Collective, and John Savage as well, of course, was in on that, and they kind of bounced ideas off each other. So there's Real Life is the first magazine album, Real World is the first song on the Buzzcocks second album, and there was loads of ideas back and forward between a lot of them, I think. And like you say, Pete wrote arguably two of the best songs on Magazine's first album, I think. I like Paul's Out on Me and Shop Levels.
Just amazing songs. Yeah. And there was that moment with Lipstick as well, which has got, it's kind of like shot by both sides.
Well, it's the same riff. Yeah. I don't think I was his best pleased when Pete did it. You thought, well, you give it me. Why have you done it yourself? But, I mean, it doesn't detract. They're both still there. It's not like they deleted Shot by Both Sides when Lipstick came out. You can still go listen to it if you want. But I think that what's good about that, if you listen to them, they both take their lyrical cue from the music, because it's less kind of sort of angular, kind of major, minor, unsettling riff, and the lyrics are both about paranoia and about not knowing what the hell's going on, which is kind of the power of a decent tune, isn't it, I think.
Maybe we should play a clip of Lipstick.
You can tell they've ambushed him here for a video, and I'm sure if they'd have told him the cameras were turning up, I think he'd have put a better shirt on than that. He might have even have took his cardigan off, possibly.
But even with Lipstick, you can see a Fred with the undertones, and then later in the 90s with Ash, and there's a real sort of template that or influence that Buzzcocks had in...
Oh, I think they were hugely influential, yeah. I mean, I mean, undertones took a lot of the cues, I think, from Buzzcocks. Not just musically, but lyrically, you know, that kind of the way the, you know, teenage kicks, that whole thing of putting you, being able to talk about that, being that age and how confusing and how messed up it all is. They definitely got that from Pete Shelley, I think. I think Morrissey took a lot of cues from Pete Shelley as well, I think.
Well, that sort of ambiguity of
apart
gender
from
and.
Try and be a nice bloke, apart from that.
Yeah.
Bit,
Great run of singles, though, Buzzcocks. One of the greatest run of singles of any group, certainly of that era.
Yeah, I mean, if you go from, like, What Do I Get up until You Say You Don't Love Me, I just think that's... I don't think there's a bad one in there. I think they're all fantastic. I mean, even Harmony in My Head, which is Steve Biddle's song, it's still a great song, and it's still... I mean, he tried to make out it was completely different and changing them all, but it's still a Buzzcocks thing, isn't it? It really is. Sits right inside with all the others.
Something about Pete as well is that he just is very accessible. He just looked like a normal bloke that you could relate to. And
yeah. I mean, one of the big things I talk about in the book is his attitude to not just to fame and being a pop star, but to his sexuality as well. You know, he's very famously bisexual. But he was one of the first, not the first, but he was one of the first people where his sexuality, it wasn't something to be kept secret, but it wasn't part of the act either. It was just who he was. And what a brilliant thing. You know, it wasn't like Elton John or Bowie who had to kind of make it kind of to become otherworldly as something that was kind of exotic, you know. But it wasn't that at all. It was just, this is who I am, you know. And he was doing that and getting on the bus home to Gorton, you know.
There's a lot of bigotry.
There was massive. If you just look at the time, do you watch it? You know, you watch an episode of Minder with a gay person in it, and they're just the underwritten kind of bigotry. And even when they're trying to be nice, it's this kind of sort of, you know, I mean, you know,
stereotype.
Well, like Mr. Humphreys in Are You Being Served? You know. But it wasn't even questioned, was it? It wasn't like, you know, it was just this undercurrent of bigotry that, I mean, I'll say it in the book. Paul Weller could quite happily sneer at the idea of being kind to queers in Strange Town, and nobody batted an eye. You know, there wasn't like, oh, you can't say that on Double the Pop. So it was, yeah, that's absolutely fine. You know, it was just an unwritten bigotry. To stand up to that was pretty brave. As I say, he wasn't getting in his limo and driving home. He was getting on the bus to go home, and everybody knew. And, you know, Manchester wasn't the nicest place for anybody. So he was a brave guy in that kind of way.
Talking about his lyrics again, there's kind of hidden depths, like... Everybody's Happy Nowadays. There seems to be a bit of a theme at times where he's talking about things being a construct in a head, not nothing exists, and it's kind of your attitude to things.
Yeah, he was, I mean, he wasn't in the best of places. He was going, his mental health wasn't perfect for a lot of the time with Buzzcocks. I mean, that was the thing about, probably still is, you know, there weren't the best places for people with fragile mental health, I don't think, being in bands in them days, because you worked all the time, didn't you? Never got a day off, and, you know, rumour has it, they were consuming certain substances which probably weren't the best thing for their mental health anyway. But he did struggle. But the way he articulated that, you know, and his struggles with mental health, and as you say, that the idea that the whole of reality is just going on in your head and nothing's actually there. And the thing about everybody's happening nowadays, it's based on Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, you know, where once everybody's made to be happy, then nobody's happy. Are they? And if you have to be happy, then that's not true happiness. So that's what that song's about. But I think a lot of his songs were dismissed as kind of like, you know, puppy love, but they weren't like that at all. They were him trying to articulate the weird headspace that he was in and brilliantly doing it, I think.
I think we've got a Top of the Pops clip. Like with every Top of the Pops clip, there might be a presenter that might have certain convictions.
The Hairy Conflict.
Hairy Conflict. Get so what's the significance of this?
Well, if you look now, he's got like a load of like £5 notes sticking out of his pocket. So before they went on Top of the Pops, they were having a discussion, him and Steve Diggle, about, they came up with this idea of, if you took a barrel load of paper money and set fire to it, is that real money? Is that a real thing? Or is that just, and kind of the KLF did the same thing, didn't they? They had a bit more money, I think.
A little bit, yeah.
And they did £1 million, didn't they? But so that was where, and so then he did that. And if you look, the half of my pound notes, he's got about £8 there. So he got they got massive stick for it. Like, okay, oh, he's a rock star now. Look at him flaunting in his wealth. But that was the kind of the idea. It didn't take much to get out moral outrage in them days, did it? I don't know where he bought that jacket as well. Unbelievable,
isn't it? It's almost like he got it from Shawaddy Waddy. So you'll have been watching this, wouldn't you?
I was watching that, yeah, yes, definitely, yeah. I mean, everybody watched Top of the Pops every week, didn't they?
Yeah.
And it was appointment viewing. I don't think anybody didn't watch it, even, you know, even when if you had to watch Legs and Co. doing Bank Robber by the Clash.
That's not a bad thing, is it?
Never went on, though, did they, the Clash? That was the thing. I think they really regretted that, because as soon as the Clash fell up, the first thing Mick Jones did with Big Ollie Land was go on Top of the Pops. I bet he was gutted in everyone on there. Because, I mean, he was a massive pop fan. I think he was a bit influenced by Peter as well, Mick Jones. If you look at Train in Vain, that's clear. I think that's him trying to write in a kind of way. So it's kind of the opposite. So you had Pete Shelley writing songs like that about personal relationships, and then Steve Diggle thought he could be Joe Strummer. But it was the other way around in the Clash. So you had Joe Strummer writing most of the songs about political with a capital P, and then Mick Jones slipping in Train in Vain, or Should I Stay, Should I Go. So kind of, I think he was influenced by Peter quite a lot, I think. In the Navy. Apparently there were a lot of gay cliches going about.
So we're playing a different kind of tension. What was it about this album in particular that you felt that would be good to feature?
I think the main thing about all right. What we're selling here. Anyway, the main thing about that is this: the run of songs on side two, which is all Pete Shelley, basically. So it's like a piece. It's not quite a concept album, but it's basically Pete Shelley describing his mental deterioration.
Are we watching the darts?
First band they ever saw live darts. Well, that's a different story. I'll do that one next time. So the side two of A Different Kind of Tension is Pete Shelley sort of writing this kind of descent into, basically, he starts off stopping believing in being in love, and by the end of the album, he doesn't believe in anything, basically. So it's this real mental deterioration, which isn't a pleasant thing, but to be able to articulate that in such a way to make such a brilliant piece, which it is a piece. I mean, side one is perfectly diverting, it's pretty good, there's some good songs on it, but side two is just the sort of epitome of his songwriting, I think.
And possibly the apex of that is I Believe.
Yeah, yeah. Really, I think it's the best thing he ever did, I think lyrically, musically, because the lyrics are just strange and interesting and contradictory, but because he was such a talented writer, it becomes a great pop song kind of despite itself, I think.
There's so many ideas musically in it as well that they could go off at. It's
yeah.
it's fitting. It fits the lyrics.
It does, yeah. Massively. And it even mentions a triangular cover, which is the cover of the album. Yeah. So that, even that, you know, it all fits. It's all of a piece. And it's, I don't think it was the ever better day, I don't think. I mean, arguably, you could say Singles Going Steady is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's cheating a bit.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But, no, but I don't think they ever bettered it. And I think they knew they couldn't better it, I think.
I think we've got a live clip, haven't we, of I Believe? There's some dark songs on this record, particularly by Pete, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
He was not having a good time.
No, he was in a mess. He was, he clearly was exhausted, mentally exhausted. I think he had, he'd contemplated suicide a couple of times. And funnily enough, that tour they did just to promote this album, yeah, Joy Division supported them. So I don't think he was in the best of places either, obviously. But funnily enough, I mentioned in the book that one of the things, why real life isn't like books, because if you ask anybody of them about that tour, all they can remember is getting absolutely smashed and breaking into hotel bars and throwing mice in each other's vans and all that. But clearly, at the centre of that, Pete, Shelley and Ian Curtis were not in the best of places, I don't think. Well, obviously.
We haven't touched on the dynamic between Steve and Pete. Very different characters. And this was a period where Steve was pushing to get more of his material on as well.
Yeah, I don't think he did himself any favours on this album. I think he set out to write as un-Pete Shelley songs as he could possibly do, which kind of was that I can see why he did that, but I don't think it worked. And I certainly, You Can't Help It, I think, ends up being a bit, lyrically, it's a bit embarrassing, really. It goes that far the other way, I mean, he's got some great songs, Pete, Steve Diggle, and I've said it before, I don't think not as good a songwriter as Pete Shelley is in any way an insult. No. So, I don't think he's particularly well represented on this album at all. He's written much better songs than there are on here.
Around 1980, around this period, so when did you start playing drums and when did the fall come in?
I started playing drums when I was 14. I got a drum kit for my 14th birthday, which was February 1977. I'd have to do the maths. No, 78 possibly. But and then Another Music, A Different Kitchen came out in the March, I think. So the first thing I learned to play the drums on, because the only time I'd ever played the drums was on the couch with Top of the Pops. So I didn't know what to do with my feet and I didn't know how to move around the kit. And then Steve, my brother, said, well, I've seen this band called Buzzcocks and they've got a song where it's all on one drum, so you should learn to play that, which was 16. So it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So that was the first thing I ever learned to play the drums. And I'd never heard it. I hadn't heard it. It didn't come out on record for another 2 months. So then, obviously, he came on the day it was released and played it, showed it me. That would have been enough. It could have been lousy. I'd still have loved it once I'd seen The Sleeve. But it wasn't lousy. It was very, very good indeed. And 16 was on there. So I was hooked from that day on. So but the good thing about that was I had two directions to go. So I could go forward with the records as they came out. And I could also go back to What Do I Get, Orgasm Addicts and Smile of Crash. So.
Was it through your brother that you got into The Four?
Yeah, yeah. I got into everything. Everything in music I've ever got into was as a result of being Steve Hanley's brother. I mean, I don't think everything, anything interesting I've ever done in music is because I was Steve Hanley's brother, basically, and still is. I'm still getting there.
You were very young.
I was very young. Yeah, 16. Yeah, funnily enough,
couldn't even officially have a drink in a pub.
No. We used to get milk on the rider. That came up for auction, the busy selling off everything, every piece of paper Marky Smith's ever touched at the moment, and they come up for auction. And one of the things that came up was this rider, and it was like, bah, 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 2 pints of milk. And there was all this comment, why are they getting 2 pints of milk? And there are 48 cans of lager on it, and you're begrudging me 2 pints of milk. But yes, I couldn't drink, I've never had a problem getting served because I've always been quite tall. But what I couldn't do was drink beer and then play drums at 16. I wasn't physically capable. So I used to drink milk before gigs, yeah. What a cute. I mean, look at that. Look at them cheekbones.
we've got a clip in a second of Garden. How did you... I mean, it's one thing playing in front of Top of the Pops. It's another thing playing with Marquis Smith.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, Steve always equates it to the frog in the saucepan. So if you put him in a cold water and then you start gradually turning the heat up, he'll never notice the difference. If you put a frog in a pan of boiling water, he'll jump out. But if that's all you know, you never notice that it's... I certainly didn't realise just how different an experience it was being in the Fall to being in any other band you care to mention until I was no longer in the Fall, you know. I came to the conclusion that it was quite hard work being in the Fall, and which is great. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons for it being quite hard work, but some of it was just hard work for the sake of being hard work, just to keep you on your toes or something, which it's all very well, but it's not very nice. If you take a step back and think, you know, we're making things more awkward than they have to be just because certain people think we respond better to awkward situations. That's great, as long as you don't factor in the fact that I've got a brain, you know. That's basically, there comes a point where you think, well, hang on a minute, you know. I don't need to be manipulated to play a good gig. I'm quite capable of playing a good gig, thanks very much. And that's, you know, but then you can't take it away because the Fall managed to keep being brilliant for 40-odd years, you know. Having said that, I don't think the last lineup was subject to the same shit. They had the mark of him by then. You know, if he did anything like that, they deliberately play badly. So, you know, if he started swapping things around, they'd do a crap gig on purpose. And I've been told that. So then he suddenly got the, well, it's not working this anymore. They kind of, because they had 10 years of the same lineup. They kind of, and I think he mellowed a bit. I think he'd have to, wouldn't you? But yeah, so I think the last lineup of the Fall was absolutely amazing, and I think they did it without as much of the nonsense that went before, which just proves you probably didn't need the nonsense anyway.
Yeah. Shall we play a bit?
See that bass rig there? That's the reason I've got this hearing aid. That's right by my left ear, that. Of course, I can't hear the finger in this.
We discussed the Fall briefly. Joy Division. What was that Manchester music scene and Buzzcocks rolling, potentially kind of nurturing it?
There's no potentially about it. They 100% did nurture it. So Joy Division went up to Pete Shelley after the pre-trial and said, how do you form a band? And he took the time to tell them how to do it. They gave the Fall their first gigs outside of Manchester. They paid for the Fall's first recording, so the Bingo Masters EP was paid for by New Ormonds, which is Buzzcocks Management Company. They were gonna at one stage. They had an idea to put it out, but they kind of ran out of money through, you know, subsidising tours with the Clash and things. The label kind of ran out of money, which is why they ended up signing to a major. But yeah, no, they took John Cooper Clark. It was Howard DeVolto who said to John Cooper Clark, You don't want to be playing these pubs and working men's clubs. You should be getting on the pub circuit. You'd go down a storm. And he did that, and they took them to London, took him to London to support. And Joy Division, they did, and the worst as well. So I say in the book, if you've got any idea that they weren't looking to make money out of a band, the fact that they took the worst to London, because nobody was ever going to make any money out of them. Appalling racket by all accounts. But but they did it because they thought it was a good thing to do. They thought it was an interesting thing to do, and they thought it was an exciting thing to do, because it was, and it wasn't just music, you know, it was graphic design, it was everything else, you know. They kind of nurtured this scene, and it was all based around those three people, really, Pete, Howard, and Richard Boone. Everything else was kind of coalesced around them. And Linda was got in, well, they all did, really, but it was a proper scene, that, and it was a proper, like the factory in New York. It was lots of interested and talented people coming together to make something greater than the sum of the parts. Doesn't happen that often.
The amount of talent in that period, and the Buzzcocks being at the centre.
Yeah. Well, Malcolm talks about that. So he was at Manchester Poly with Linda, who then introduced him to Howard DeVolto and Pete Shelley. He shared a flat with John McGeer and Judy Blame, who was the designer, the guy... designer, and he was the way he said it, he's sharing a flat with one of the most talented guitarists of the late sort of, you know, 70s and 80s. Judy Blame was this kind of iconic kind of designer, and he was a friend of Pete Shelley, and that was all just one scene, and none of them were rich, and none of them were, there was no nepotism involved. It was just this amazing group of people came together and created something.
We've got a clip in a second of Love Will Tear Us Apart, Joy Division, but that's... You're familiar with the rehearsal space?
Yes, it's that this place here is called TJ Davidson's, and it was where all the bands in Manchester rehearsed. And if you look now, this is, bear in mind, this has been tidied up to make a video in it. And I promised my wife I wasn't going to share, but this is the biggest shithole you'll ever see. And this is where all the bands in Manchester rehearsed. And Buzzcocks had their own room that they rented out, and they kept all their gear in here. God alone knows how many padlocks they had on the door, because it was a death trap, the whole place. It was massive as well, freezing cold Victorian kind of warehouse, basically. So if it got too hot in the summer, you'd break one of the windows, and then if it got too cold in the winter, you'd put some cardboard over the broken window. that was basically it. It was a death trap.
Is that something that's particular to Manchester? Is this all disused?
Yeah, there's a lot of disused mills and things in Manchester, and there's still rehearsal rooms tonight. If you look, go around Stockport, there's a lot of these, but most of them have acquired a sweeping brush in the last 40 years. So. They used to make fires out of the rubbish in the corner in the winter if it got too cold. But it wasn't central heating. There's a lot of famous pictures of Joy Division in this room. Kevin Cummins took them. See, there's a picture of Ian Curtis sat against this black wall, and that's in there as well.
Did you have much contact with Joy Division at that time?
I wouldn't have dared to speak to them, really.
All right.
I did see, they played this place in Bowden called Bowden Vale Youth Club. So I went to see them. Steve's band, pre-4 band called Sat9, supported them. So I went to see them in this tiny club. There's bits of film of it, actually. But that was just before they recorded the first album. They were just, I think that was as good as they ever got, John. It was in that early. I saw them a few times. They were absolutely brilliant, but I wouldn't have had the... I mean, Pete Hookie was quite a scary bloke, I think, you know. He had a beard. I mean, nobody had a beard, didn't he? he looked like a U-boat captain. But no, I wouldn't have dared to speak. I didn't dare to speak to Marky Smith. I wasn't going to speak to Joy Division.
End of Buzzcocks. So you've talked about Pete kind of almost having a breakdown, them touring. But I guess one of the catalysts was the fact that he was working with Martin Russian.
Yeah.
And then Homo Sapien came about, but it just didn't really fit Buzzcocks' sound, did it?
Well, one of the things about Buzzcocks is they set their sound perfectly really early on, I think. So when the first album came out, that was like perfect Buzzcocks sound. This is the first Clash album.
Yeah.
They've got a long way to go to be, you know, it's tinny and it's not particularly... I want to say well-played. I don't mean musically proficient or anything. It's a bit... They sound like they're terrified on that album. And they had a lot of places they could go with their sound, whereas Buzzcocks were this perfect sort of thing. So if you listen to the first album, you listen to the album that we're going to listen to, it's this great sound that they have. But they never really stray from that formula. So it took quite a will to move Buzzcocks to a new sound. And I think they would have had to do that at some point. But the way Pete was, it was easier. So they start recording the fourth album. Pete's got two riffs. Steve Diggle's got 735 songs. So none of which Pete likes. So... Martin Russian comes down and says, this is chaos, we can't go on here. We can't do anything. The thing about Buzzcocks, they're never going to work unless Pete Shelley is committed. And he wasn't committed to his own songs, he certainly wasn't committed to Pete's. So, to Steve's. So Martin Russian said, well, we'll close down recording, you come back with me and we'll write some songs. Because he was building a studio in his garden, Genetic. So they wrote the songs and, well, we'll use a drum machine, you know. And so they wrote the songs and then he suddenly realised that these were great and it would have been to their detriment for them to dismantle those songs as they were, take them back to Buzzcocks and rebuild them as Buzzcocks songs. So they basically, Pete Shelley just said, well, Martin said, you should put this out. Never mind using these as demos. And the thing about that is Martin Russian created all these sounds for that album. And basically, if you listen to Dare by the Human League, they're all the same sounds. I mean, it's remarkably similar. So he did that. And then kind of to his detriment, he just... broke the band up without, he didn't go down back home and say, oh, listen, I'm in this place now, I'm going to break the band. He just sent them all a solicitor's letter saying.
I mean, that's one way to split up the group, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, they didn't speak, they were, all three of them were very, very upset and annoyed by that for years. I mean, understandably, in a way. But it was quite tense. It was a different kind of tension, if you will. There. But yeah, so it wasn't the nicest way to split the group up, I think. But he wasn't in a good place, you know. That's what John Marr said. Martin Rush, like all the best producers, was halfway to being a counsellor, really. And he could see that Pink Sherry wasn't in the right place to record with a band. He needed to be on his own, and he needed to give his own ideas without having to filter them through 300 people, three other people. So he did that, you know. And it's a great album, Homo Sapien. It's a fantastic album. So it was better than a fourth Buzzcocks album would have been, I think.
Should we play a clip of that, Dre? Lyrically, he's playing with his sexuality a little bit there.
I think I think by this point he's being open about his saying boys and things, but he built it by then. He built the kind of model where it was singing. It was anybody could sing to anybody. That's the other key thing about Buzzcocks. Most of Pete Shelley's songs, it could be a boy singing to a girl singing to a boy singing to a boy, whatever. As far as he was concerned, your sexuality and your gender was a fluid thing. And one of the things he says, it's one of the great things about writing in English as opposed to French or Italian, where the sex of the person singing is always explicit in the lyric because of the way the language works, whereas in English, anybody can sing to anyone. And he did that very, very well, I think. It's a great example of his art matching his persona, really. He was like that in life, and he was like that when he wrote songs.
After Pete died, the outpouring of people talking about him and his legacy and what it was like was kind of different to a lot of artists. It was Glenn Matlock, for example. Yeah. He said that he showed a different way for the punk scene to.
He did, and he didn't buy into any of the cliches of punk. If you look at any of the things that if you ask someone who knows nothing about what punk, he didn't do any of that really. Maybe a little bit the first Die in His Hair, but he wasn't aggressive, and it was cerebral and sensitive without being soft. You know, it's quite a good trick to pull off. You know, it wasn't aggressive, but it wasn't mealy-mouthed either. He said what he had to say, and he said it really well, and it was inclusive as well, I think. And it wasn't about anger, wasn't just about anger, which there was a lot of anger in punk. I mean, I think he anticipated post-punk in a lot of ways in the way he wrote a lyric, you know, because the way punk moved on and when it became really interesting, you know, musically. I mean, it was really interesting as a phenomenon, but I don't think a lot of the bands became really, really interesting until a bit later on, you know, Susan the Banshees and Magazine, Public Image Limited, you know. That if you listen to the Sex Pistols, they're great, but shorn of Johnny Rotten, they're not an innovative music, you know. They could be free, couldn't they? In a lot of, which I'm not knocking.
No,
you know, they're great, but you know, I think
it's a bit of a dead end. It's like there's only so many albums you could do in that style.
Well, one Sex Pistols, again,
And then finally, maybe that's one of the themes is that keeps coming out from what you're saying is that just Pete was ahead of his time.
I think he was years ahead of his time in his attitude to lots of things. And I think he was the catalyst or one of the catalysts from dragging Manchester out of post-war, really. Well, that whole scene did it for Manchester much more than it did in a lot of places. And a lot of places took a lot longer to regenerate, you know. Whereas Manchester artistically, and I mean, you know, there's Tony Wilson is in there, but it was the factory was built on, I think, on what Buzzcocks did to a great degree. And I think they inspired him, Tony Wilson, to get involved in music in a way that he possibly hadn't got quite the same before. I mean, a lot of respect for Richard Boone. Richard Boone, of course, ended up working for Rough Trade as well. So I think that whole thing that they created was massively influential and still is, I think.
Well, that's a great summary, I think. Are we having a break?
We are having a break. And during the break, you can notice that this wonderful book is on sale. And Isabel, if you would like to, it's not only this, there's a few other books of Paul's as well. Isabel from Root will look after you. And Amanda and Jez are doing the raffle. So we'll see you in 20 minutes. So, yeah, a round of applause, please.
After listening to the record, we had a post-album discussion and a bit of a Q&A.
I've just got one question and one comment combined into one, really. Side two must be Pete's masterpiece.
Yes. Yeah. That was easy, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, do you know if there was a conscious decision to load the album up that way?
Yeah, it was his decision. He sort of said, I've got this kind of suite that I want to do as side two. And I think he kind of horse traded and said to Steve Dillon, you can have three on side one, because he'd only ever had one on any of the other album. So he kind of, the trade off was he got three songs on the album, but it meant Pete had side two for himself. I think that's how it worked.
It just works so
it's
well.
It's just a piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, listening to it out loud, it's obviously not something I've done that often. I mean, I've listened to it live, because when they toured that album, they did the whole of side two as a live. But it's very hypnotic, isn't it? Because it's just like that repetition that sort of messes with your head a bit.
You've got more of that thread of, you can hear Franz Ferdinand.
You can, yeah. You can hear House of All in there if you're really listening.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all.
Yeah. I don't know if we want to open it up.
Yeah, questions can be, don't have to be about the album, it can be about The Fall and Rodgers.
Building on that point about how you put an album together, in your experience in The Fall, was it the band that worked out how to lay out an album, or is it a creative decision in terms of, right, we've got a bundle of songs, this is the best way to put them down on vinyl?
I'm going to shock you here. But in my experience, the band had very little input into how the album was laid out. I mean, certain albums are kind of, I mean, X Induction Hour is the one that was, that's not just, this is how many songs we've got, we better about time we did an album. There's a bit of thought going, a lot of thought going into that, I think. It certainly had nothing to do with me, and I don't think any of the other members of the band would have claimed any credit for how that album panned out. Some albums are just, this is how many songs, and again, but I'm pretty sure most of the people who were ever in The Fall will tell you maybe Live at the Wish Charles might have been more of a collaboration. It probably was more of a collaboration, but after that, we did what we were told. You'll be shocked to hear, yeah. Which is okay, you know, that kind of thing, I think, that's okay. I think the democracy can get in the way sometimes with certain things like that. I mean, even House of All, Martin writes the lyrics, he decided the order it went in because, I mean, I think, you know, it's like a camel's a horse designed by committee, isn't it? I think that sometimes it pays to have someone with a vision.
Questions, please. Roger's got a question. It's just do it, Roger.
It's not so much a question as an apology to you, Paul, because on two occasions, first occasion was in Manchester in June 1984. Me and my mate went to see The Fall at the Hacienda, and beforehand, we were having a couple of beers in the Britain's Protection pub. We came out of there not knowing where the Hacienda was, where the gig was taking place. And this bloke was walking past, and I just said to him, "Hey, mate, can you tell us where the Hacienda is?" And this guy pointed down there, and walked off towards the Hacienda. And I realised afterwards it was you. On another occasion, which was fairly recently, about a year ago, we were in Bristol to see Half Man Half Biscuit, and Karen nudged me and said, "It's Paul Hanley there in Bristol, in the Rough Trade record shop." And Karen nudged me and said, "There's Paul Hanley there." And I didn't hear her. And I said, "Oh." And she said,
"To whisper,
Paul Hanley."
"Hear me,
Paul Hanley." And I says, "Oh." And here were you. And I think we thought you took offence, and you just walked out of the shop. So I want to apologise on two occasions. I've not recognised you. So you're one of the few people.
So the first time when I was the height of my popularity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't know who I was.
Yeah, I didn't.
The second time, you weren't even going to the bleeding gig.
I know. So, apologies. So, I just...
Not accepted.
Have there been any other occasions when people have not recognised you?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Can I ask another question? This is about the album.
Question, yeah?
It's about the... About the album. The album title, who came up with that?
What?
A different kind of tension. It's like...
I know exactly who came up with that.
Right.
John Savage came up with it in the review of Love Bites.
Okay.
He says, there's a quote in it, and he says, Steve Diggle's songs are very much like Ringo's songs on the Beatles album, A Different Kind of Tension. So that's where that
okay.
came
from. Right.
Yeah.
I thought it might have been something to referring to, you know, Diggle and Shelley.
Yeah, kind well, of it like, is, yeah.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, with any of these things, if you pick up a phrase,
yeah,
who's come up with that? Is it... The fact that you're using it kind of makes it your phrase in a way, doesn't it, I think? But yeah, no, it was John Savage. Yeah. I thought you were going to say I didn't know, didn't you?
Yeah, if I can. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
1983, I went to
just
see...
Just tell me.
Yeah.
I hope you...
Yeah, I got dragged on a bus by this guy to see a band in Wakefield, Hellfire Club, you guys played.
Yeah.
I think it was Brix's first gig. I'd never heard you before. Two drummers singing songs about football hooligans and lorry drivers, and just fantastic. It changed my thoughts on music and how I appreciated music in future. Have you ever... been to a gig as good as that? You know, you might not, you know, that changed your...
Well,
your
yes.
Yeah.
I'd have to be some kind of a tosser to say I've never been to a gig as good as the one I played.
One that changed your musical thoughts and...
changed my musical thoughts? Public Image Limited. I saw them twice. Not the original lineup, because they had... Jim Walker on drums on the album, but I think he only did three or four gigs. But we went to they played it at Bellevue, and it was like 2 months after Public Image, the first album, came out, which is still to this day. And they played, yeah, and they were lousy. They had a drummer who they picked up that day, I think. He didn't know the songs, and Keith Levine, the ever-friendly Keith Levine, was trying to teach him the songs as they went along, and he must have played 30 minutes, and one of them was Belsham was a Gas, so they were clearly struggling for material.
Yeah.
But then, in 1979, the Public Image did this secret gig. They were on some Granada programme, and they did this secret gig at the Factory in the Russell Club, obviously, in Hume. And nobody knew about it, but as it turned out, Carl Burns was working as a doorman at the, and we got to hear about it, and so we went down. I was only 15, maybe even just up, and we managed to get in, and we were queuing to get in, and the bouncer said, "There's no way you're 18, you can't come in here." And Tony Wilson said, "Oh, go on, let him in. He's been in the queue 20 minutes." So I got in, and Public Image played that night, and they were basically practicing the songs of Metal Box. Mostly,
yeah.
But that was, and they were all in a fantastic mood. Even Keith Levine smiled at one stage. But it was, they were just fantastic. They had Richard Dedansky on the drums, who was in the 101ers, and he was brilliant. And it was, and the first time, I'm reliably informed, that was the first time Jar Wobble stood up to play the bass.
Good.
So that gig is seared into my memory. It was just fantastic. Pete Shelley was there. Pete Shelley was sat in the bar talking to John Lydon.
Yeah,
and it was magnificent, that gig, and it was really ragass. They were obviously didn't know the songs properly, but the difference between that and when they, because that was built up as like they were playing this massive venue in Bellevue, King's Hall, they were just shocking. But that gig, it was just like this band is just incredible, and obviously they were when Metal Box came out.
Did you sense at the time that so 83, 84 period how good you guys were? Did you have a sense that you were an important band?
No,
at that time?
I had a sense that I loved what we were doing, but it's a difficult thing to know. how important. I mean, you don't want to know, do you? You'd be a,
probably
not. You would be. You want to be walking around thinking we're the most important man in the world?
Yeah.
You'd be, you'd be Morrissey, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And I was only the drummer, so you know.
Excellent.
Pass it over to Simon.
I just wanted to ask your opinion on what, on a, in an ongoing sense, what do you think of Diggle as a singer and a frontman?
I think he's got every right to do it. I think he had Pete's blessing to carry on. He's had, everyone I spoke to with the book, so John Marr, Pete's widow, Steve Garvey, they all said, yeah, you know, good luck to him. I'm kind of biased. For me, he was the guy who sang one song on Buzzcocks' album. When I got into Buzzcocks, he had one song on an album. I mean, Autonomy's half Pete's head anyway. And he became more and more to the fore. And possibly coincidentally, possibly not, I got less and less interested in him as he came more to the fore, which is nothing, it's nothing to do with him. That's not his fault. It's just, for me, they were Pete Shelley's band. And clearly, Buzzcocks weren't Pete Shelley's, but they weren't Pete Shelley's band, but now DeVoto was singing. And I don't think without Steve Diggle, they'd have carried on as long as they did. He was kind of the force that kept them going. And there is an argument to say, if you're playing a festival in Mexico where people know Ever Fall in Love and two other songs, Pete shuffling on and saying, "All right, mate, have you had your tea?" might not have been enough. But I really don't care. To have seen them when I thought they were just the best band in the world and there was no artifice, what you got on stage was who they were. For that to then become Pete Townsendisms and all that kind of stuff, it kind of got away from me. But I say that's more to do with me than to do with him, I think. But I think he's got, as I said it before, not as good a songwriter as Pete Shelley isn't an insult as far as I'm concerned. He's got some good songs with Buzzcocks. But I don't know if I can say any more diplomatically than that, really. They're not what I think of when I think of Buzzcocks is with him singing, that's all. That wasn't too harsh, was it?
Okay. As a man who's shaken the hand of Buddy Rich.
Okay.
I just thought I'd drop that in, actually.
You didn't squeeze it too hard, did you?
I was pissed at the time. I'm going to have to digress now, aren't I? Yeah. It was at Wakefield Theatre Club. You were there?
I was
there,
Malky Booth.
Ah. Did you speak to him afterwards?
No.
I did.
I'm really enjoying this question.
Yeah. We're going to get there. Before I ask you this question, he'd been on the Parkinson show and the husband...
I've seen that one with Roy Castle. That one. Is that the one?
No, I can't remember. I was pissed watching it. The Osmonds were massive at the time, and he said to Parkinson, and he was talking, and he came up and he says, "And that little Jimmy Osmond, I'd like to kick his head in." And it made all the front page newspapers day after. And they were absolute hell on. And when he came on stage on the theatre club, he had this great big badge that said, "I love the Osmonds." And me and my mate, Mo Keith, we went outside and Buddy Rich is there smoking a cigarette. And we went over and this bouncer tried to, you know, leave Mr. Rich alone. He was really horrible, this bouncer. And Buddy Rich.
Do you not think that people like that, they pay their bouncers to go so they don't have to be?
Well,
No, I'm serious.
Buddy Rich said, "Hey, guy," he said, take a fucking hike. He says, "These are friends of mine."
Yeah.
And he shook his hands. And I always remember, it was like a wet sponge.
Oh,
it was really weird. Anyway, the question is...
Who paid the golf ball?
Some of your favourite and influential drummers.
I've got to start, beginning and finish with Ringo Starr. I think he's just the most brilliant drummer. And not even just his playing, just the sound of his kit. Because you listen to 60s records, you know, you listen to... I mean, the Kinks have got some... He's a great drummer as well, but yeah. You listen to the Stones. I mean, half of them early Stones, the drums sound like they're coming in sludge, don't they? Whereas Ringo Starr... Yeah, I always... You know where you're going? If the snare sounds right as a drummer, and it sounds like they've taken a bit of care to make the snare drum sound right. I think that's a big thing. I'm obviously going to say John Mara as well, aren't I? Carl Burns was a massive influence for me, which, as we saw before, to end up playing in a band. There's a bit in that film of Garden where I look at him and we both do this drum roll, and that's the highlight of my career. That 5.5 seconds, not even that, probably 2.5. But that, to play with John Mara, Steve Morris, I thought was brilliant. Nick Knox out of the Cramps, I thought he was fantastic. You know,
yeah.
One snare, one tom, floor tom, sunglasses on, pitch black. I mean, you can't get better than that. You can't. No. Topper Edens, I think, was an amazing drummer. I mean, there's a difference. If you listen to The Clash with Terry Chimes and you listen to him with Topper, just listen to the sound of the snare. The snare sound is more exciting. Never mind what they play. He sounds like he's not been asked tuning it properly. That's about as muso as I get. Which isn't particularly muso, but... So, Ringo. Well, as I said, we're going to start and end with Ringo. Ringo starts the best drummer in the world.
Very good. Anybody else? Shall I ask the last question of the night, then?
So who have you met in this question? I said to Johnny Cash...
I photographed Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
So take that. And I met him. Bloke called Paul Hanley once, twice, three, four times now, is it?
Yeah.
So.
Have you met Johnny Cash?
Yeah.
Wow. I am.
Photographs are available on my website. KevinReynolds.co.uk. Yeah, you've got it, yeah. Yeah, it's in Johnny Cash photos, is it? Yeah. Do you want me to get on the stage and talk about the photo? Yeah. I met this year. Anyway, the last question then. So, when you come back next year, which fall album are you going to pick?
Yeah.
We do want him to come back, don't we?
You want me to pick a fall album, really? Seriously? Yeah. I do like the Wish Trials, so that'd be interesting. I'm not on that.
How long is it? It's not a double, is it?
No.
Yeah, we'd love you to, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Strange blue stories untold. Ooh, yeah.